You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The Mississippi River Basin drains more than 40% of the water in the continental United States and supports a tremendous amount of biodiversity. But it's also a major hub of industry, and the water flowing from it into the Gulf of Mexico is carrying a staggering array of pollutants. These last two facts have had a tremendous impact on people's lives and a part of the country that some have started calling Cancer Alley. Joining me now is Kate Orff, an assistant professor at Columbia University and founder of SCAPE, a landscape architecture studio in Manhattan. Her book, Petrochemical America, combines photographs by Richard Misrach with research and data from the region. It's published by Aperture, and I'm very pleased to welcome Kate Orff to our program today. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So I wasn't sure when I first looked at this whether this was a photo book or whether this was a book about a serious problem in America. It's about a serious problem in America.
That's right. I mean, I think the genesis of the book was, in fact, this incredible series of photographs that Richard Misrach took in 1998 when he visited the region. But I think what the project does is take those photographs as essentially a starting point. And in my part, what I call the ecological atlas, I'm essentially looking at these photographs, starting to sequence them and integrate them into a kind of more comprehensive narrative that integrates data and builds a much more comprehensive story of not only that place of what has been called Cancer Alley, but then also spiral out to talk about the national issues in energy and oil and gas.
Well, some of the photographs in this book are quite beautiful. How much of the problems there can be spotted simply by looking at the river? I know I've been on Newtown Creek, and when you look at the surface of the water, you're very aware of the fact you shouldn't stick your hand into it.
Right. There's that no swim sense with the color of the water in Newtown Creek and the Gowanus for sure. And I think what's interesting when Richard went to the area between Baton Rouge and New Orleans in 1998, I think it was very different than it is now. I think many of the chemical plants and have begun to sort of clean up their act. But the photographs in the book, I agree, are incredibly beautiful, incredibly compelling, as every Misrach photo is. But there also is a sort of richness to them where you have an immediate sort of aesthetic response to the image, like the swamp and pipeline image, which is on the cover of the book. There's this kind of rust-colored, beautiful, you know, pipe moving through a kind of a muddy green swamp, which is just quite an image to behold. But then it has these layers of, like, what's in the pipe? Why is this swamp so discolored? And that's really where I came in, which was to try to look at the sort of rich poetics of each photograph and begin to, you know, both in an imaginative way and in a way that was almost working like a detective, if you will, to try to understand the many stories and images that are embedded in each image.
Well, when we think of ecological issues in Louisiana, the Deepwater Horizon oil spill in the Gulf is what probably comes to most people's minds first. What about the health of the lower Mississippi River? How did the two compare?
Well, I think it's very interesting you mentioned Deepwater Horizon, because that explosion, in fact, happened during the writing of this book, and Richard was in the area, and I was writing the chapter on waste. So I don't mean to make light of that explosion in any way, but, you know, to us, when we were working, it seemed like just another industrial accident, albeit at a much larger scale, but it seemed very much in line with the accidents and explosions and spills that we had been tracking, both through Richard's photography and through my mapping and data project.
Well, this 150-mile corridor between Baton Rouge and New Orleans has been called River Road, Chemical Corridor, but also Cancer Alley. What kinds of health problems do people who live near it and rely on its water come down with?
Right. Well, it's true. It's called Cancer Alley, and this was basically a term that almost like came out of the environmental justice movement a couple decades ago.
Are cancer rates considerably higher in this
well,
area?
Well, this is one of the things we researched in the book, because beyond just cancer, and there are a number of chemicals manufactured there that are simply known carcinogens, and we used and referenced the President Obama's cancer panel data in the report very stringently. But beyond cancer, I think what we did learn is that There are other ailments such as reproductive disorders, endocrine disruption, stillbirth, and so on, that have afflicted people in that region. But a big part of the discovery of this book, I think, was that I went there thinking about people who are essentially living next to these plants. And there are incredible stories about cancer clusters of, like, say, rare brain cancers, or a cluster of miscarriage and so on, really very tragic community stories. But I think one of the things, again, that I tried to do in the book was to not only describe in detail the health ailments of people living proximate to these places, but the fact is that these petrochemicals and are really embedded in almost every facet of American life. They're in bisphenol A in our cups. They're our vinyl siding. They're in children's toys in the form of phthalates and so on. So it became very interesting for me to scale up not only, you know, some of the environmental questions, but also to scale up some of the health questions, to, you know, do justice to the people who are living there, but also to talk about environmental health more broadly.
On the other hand, a lot of the things that are produced along the river, and we're really talking about the river that starts in Minnesota and comes down, because the pollutants start at the top and they just keep on being added to along the way. Isn't that true?
Right.
A lot of the products are things that we also rely on, positive things, and those are and defenders of the current situation say, well, we couldn't be producing the things that Americans want without a certain amount of
sacrifice.
Sacrifice.
And that's really true. And I think the book tries to talk about that in a way that American consumption patterns, American standard of living, in these bigger houses made of petrochemically driven products, where we drive to and from, you know, our cars to places that we worship and go to school. You know, the American lifestyle, as it has developed post-war, has really been driven by cheap and abundant oil and petrochemicals. And I think one of the theses of the books is that, you know, I kind of talk about the American landscape as a kind of petrochemical machine at this point, that we've developed the settlement pattern and now we need to essentially feed the beast. And I think that will generate a very different set of questions in the next 100 years than it has in the past 100 years when we've been relying on this.
So we have all these hazardous and toxic substances that are dropped into the river, and then they all come down to the Mississippi Delta. And then what happens?
Well, I mean, it's you mentioned the river as well as a whole, and I think
there is also farmland.
Yeah, and that's the book. My section is divided into a number of chapters: oil, infrastructure, waste, displacement, ecology, food, and landscape. So what I'm trying to do is weave together all and connect the dots between these different crises that are seemingly unconnected. So, you know, but that need to be reconnected in our dialogue. And you mentioned the length of the Mississippi River. There's a really strong diagram in the food chapter, which actually does connect the length of the Mississippi, and it describes how pesticides, nitrogen-based fertilizers, and herbicides are manufactured at plants on the lower Mississippi in the Cancer Alley Zone, are shipped up by barge to the sort of Corn Belt and Soy Belt region up, and essentially applied to the leafy extents of the entire Mississippi the Mississippi watershed. And including, you know, chemicals like atrazine beyond fertilizers and so on. And then what, you know, those chemicals and fertilizers then come back down the Mississippi in the form of pollution and runoff, creating a dead zone in the Delta. So the Mississippi as a whole is a really, I think, important story to bring into our discussion of the landscape.
So we have a little bit of this and a little bit of that. And we don't pay as much attention to it as we do to a big story like an oil rig exploding.
Right. I mean, I think the idea of Deepwater Horizon, something, there's a definite kind of newsworthiness of an accident happening at one point in time, and certainly the sort of effects on people's lives and livelihoods.
But those are all more manageable in an odd way.
They're more manageable. And so what I tried to bring to this book was a way of, like, conceptualizing the environment and a way of pulling together these stories that are seemingly not connected. So connecting, like I just described, the stories between food and ecology, where the runoff from our sort of monocultural zone in the Midwest creates essentially a dead zone where we are not, you know, benefiting from the oysters and crabs and shellfish and the rich sources of protein down at the Gulf, connecting stories between toxic waste and the displacement of communities, not only in the Cancer Alley region, but across the world as we begin to export our most polluting industries. And then connecting our consumption of oil, gas, and petrochemicals to this landscape that we have made and now that we now must maintain, and raising questions about and trying to point the direction and draw like a cognitive map, if you will, that helps to frame the last 100 years of modernization in the landscape. And also there's a glossary that points to how we might begin to break those cycles and how we might begin to shine a spotlight on individuals or governments or so on who are making change.
My guest is Kate Orff, assistant professor at Columbia University, and the author of the text of a book called Petrochemical America. It also features photographs by Richard Misrach, and it's published by a photographic publisher, Aperture. You mentioned the dead zones. Now, how do the dead zones work? All these chemicals come down there, and they create a situation where nothing can live?
Well, yes. I mean, in the food chapter, there's a I should say in my part, it's not only text. It's called a sort of an atlas, where there's a series of very intense drawings and diagrams that integrate Richard's photographs. And so for example, there's a drawing titled Dead Zones, and that drawing describes these multiple layers of what I call the dead zones. That there's not the dead zone is traditionally a hypoxic zone, which is in the Gulf of Mississippi, which is where there's so much nitrogen pollution that there's almost nothing can live. But my point in the book is that there are multiple dead zones. There's a dead zone also in the Midwest in terms of a sort of a monoculture. There's a dead zone in the American diet, in that we're now, you know, relying on this fuel source or food source that is propped up by this fossil fuel extraction.
Well, the Mississippi Delta was generally considered to be one of the richest places for farming in the country because of all of the nutrients that came down the river. Is that no longer the case?
Well, I think that what we found when we were there, and certainly there is sugarcane production, which itself is quite chemically intense, but I think when I wrote the book, it was the shrimping season was the worst ever on record, for example, and you know, there's the sense that, you know, I had the sense, you know, going there, that this is this incredible American resource. You know, it's called the America's Wetland, and through a series of, you know, levying the river and this kind of rich sediment that was depositing over the many years, to not only create these pockets where we could extract oil and gas, but creating this incredibly rich, fertile landscape that has been so productive, that is a landscape that is in crisis. And, you know, there's also that Delta's experiencing extreme land loss, and we have a diagram of that in the book. And, you know,
so the wetlands are disappearing?
They're disappearing.
40% of all America's wetlands are in the Mississippi.
At an astonishing rate. And I think it's true that if we were somehow losing land to one of our, you know, Canadian or Mexican neighbors, there would be a real outcry. But because it's this environmental system and it's so hard to see, and a big part of my thesis here was visualizing these issues, it's so hard to see that it's hard to kind of generate action about it. And that's what I'm trying to do, is, you know, make a book that can be a format for change.
Well, as long as we're talking statistics, you mentioned seafood. 20 to 25% of the nation's domestically produced seafood comes from Louisiana. But also 30% of our crude oil is produced and extracted in this part of the country. How many refineries are there in this part of Louisiana?
Well, I would say there's over 100 in the zone that we were looking at.
And we're talking about the biggest names, Shell,
all
Dow,
the big,
Chemical.
Right, Exxon. They're all the big players are there, including the big agribusiness players, ConAgra, Syngenta, and so on. And so it's really incredible concentration of, you know, corporate production in the zone. And I think what the book tries to do, at least in the sort of the chapter called Displacement, is juxtapose the corporate kind of, you know, model of enriching basically distant shareholders and contrast that with the actual people who are living right next door.
So for a long time, it produced most of our oil and gas, but hasn't that been extracted? Is that why we're starting to see more and more offshore drilling these days?
Yes. And in fact, we have an incredible image on page 143 in the book, which is, you know, shows these tentacles that it shows the entire Gulf of Mexico and how tentacles of oil and gas pipelines and platforms are reaching further and further off the coast of the continental shelf, drilling in deeper, deeper water. Like there's one called the Perdido platform, which is in something like 10,000, you know, square feet of water, which cost $3 billion to build. So you can kind of see it's really kind of a portrait of addiction. And on that map, we also map the extents of the deep water spill. So it sets up this dialogue for, I guess you could say, a visual graphic that speaks to America's addiction to chemicals and oil.
And are we also seeing some fracking there now?
Well, natural gas, and I'm sure your listeners would be interested in that, but natural gas is also a sort of a game changer in this region. A lot of the shift has been to natural gas, and the prices in natural gas have really changed the game. And I think you'll see that our book focuses really on the effects of oil and gas extraction in the Gulf on land and out in the water, and the effects on communities, the environment, public health, and ecologies. But natural gas, I think, raises many of these same issues in different ways, of course, but all around the country.
Hasn't the course of the river also been redirected at times throughout history?
Yeah, in fact, we have in the ecology section of the book a map which overlays all the courses that are charted of the river over many, many years. And of course, it was straightened and levied after the floods. And I guess that was in the 30s. And so, of course, that's created many, you know, positive impacts and that there's less severe flooding. But I think there's also many unintended consequences of that massive levying initiative, which include spewing all of the nutrient-rich sediment way off the shelf so that these wetlands cannot be replenished.
Now, you have a lot more scary stuff in this book, but the whole thing, everything you're describing sounds like a total disaster. Don't we have an EPA? The EPA be getting involved in correcting some of these problems?
Well, in fact, the EPA has played a role. An outgoing administrator, Lisa Jackson, I believe, went to Tulane. So I think she's very aware of many of these issues. But I think, you know, just the EPA isn't going to do it. I mean, EPA is essentially a regulatory body. But I think what I'm trying to do in the book by conceptualizing the environment and conceptualizing the interrelated aspects of these problems, what I'm trying to say is that these issues are not confined geographically to this area. They're in fact issues that if there's always a consumption-driven America where we have the highest kind of energy footprint, the highest ecological footprint, there's always going to be a cancer alley. And so many of the problems, while localized, are also problems that we all share in and we benefit from, but then the negative effects are often localized.
We saw after Hurricane Sandy all these comparisons with the impact of Katrina in this area. Louisiana perhaps is more susceptible to climate change. But in the end, aren't we talking about some very similar problems?
Yes. I mean, I think that the problems of water pollution and excess nitrogen and incredible vulnerability to rising sea levels is something that all coastal cities will share. In fact, my office, Scape, did a project called Oyster Texture for the Museum of Modern Art, and that project was about a community-based vision for a revitalized New York Harbor that included reef building and community-based oyster gardening and basically trying to regenerate a sort of an infrastructure. And I think...
Well, we used to be the major source of oysters in the world. We don't have oysters anymore, but oysters clean the water, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, I became obsessed with oysters, so I can talk about oysters for the duration of the show. But oysters are amazing creatures. They can filter water, you know, filter excess nitrogen out of the water. They agglomerate into reefs, and they're just one of many strategies, I think, that include kind of hard strategies and soft infrastructural living strategies that we need to build a sort of hybrid eco-infrastructural approach, not only in New York, but also in the Mississippi Delta region.
And many of the oysters we eat these days come from the Gulf region.
You know, I would love to know where they do come from, because I think there were incredible issues with hurricanes and the mixture, you know, the oyster needs a sort of very subtle mix of fresh and salt water. And I know that the oyster farmers went through some really tough times after these recent hurricane and events. And I think increasing hurricanes and sea level rise will only make them worse. There's a problem of saltwater intrusion in the Delta area that threatens many of the freshwater species.
How do the people who live in the area you study view the industries that surround them and the pollution it generates?
I think it's very mixed. I mean, the term Cancer Alley has been trumpeted by many to shine a spotlight on the region and call attention to their problems, but it's also seen as being a stigma by others. And I think I've been inspired completely by the groups, the community organizations that have begun to pull together and begin to tell their stories. And so, but for every inspiring kind of story, there's also a very, incidents that give you great pause and make one incredibly concerned about safety and about just pollution and how this equation of extraction and pollution and waste needs to change, and that companies, you know, that have externalized these costs of waste and health and so on for so long, I think there's a kind of a brave new world that we need to consider. It's a new year, and a, you know, with a new, newly elected president, that it might be a very great time to, you know, reconsider, you know, our commitment to the landscape.
Well, do people talk about the trade-off between health and jobs?
Yes, and I think that's somewhat misplaced in the sense that many of the jobs, I mean, in this particular area, this is an area that exports bulk chemicals to other areas, so to more job-intensive places like Ohio or New Jersey, where those bulk chemicals are transformed into things like plastic bags or cups or toothbrushes or steering wheels. But this area that we're talking about is really a producer of bulk chemicals. There's not a lot of jobs. Of course, every job is incredibly meaningful. But I think what I would be very interested in is how, you know, the reinvestment in the community as a whole in education, and, you know, Louisiana ranks at the bottom of a whole bevy of social indicators, incarceration, education, and so on. And just seems to me that in the American context, that there should be more of an investment in places and in people.
Kate Orff is an assistant professor at Columbia University, founder of Scape, a landscape architecture studio in Manhattan. She has written a book that includes the photographs of Richard Mizrach called Petrochemical America. It's published by Aperture. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thanks a lot.